All right, everybody, you know how much I love TrueCar because it's changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save, get this, an average of $3,221 off manufacturer's suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then, register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step, very simple. Just print out your savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com. Hey, folks, welcome to this week's show. Very excited to have on a Golden Globe winning actor and someone that I've admired for a long, long time, Ron Perlman. Thanks for being on the show. Really appreciate it, man.
My pleasure.
Ron, as you know, may know him from the role of Vincent in Beauty and the Beast and Clay in Hellboy, and has a new book out called Easy Street, The Hard Way, a memoir. And in looking at the book and, you know, sort of just from what I know about you, first of all, you and I have a little something in common. You were a swimmer growing up, and so was I. What was your stroke? Did you have a specialty that you were good at?
I had no specialty, which is why I ended up in the acting department.
Is that right?
My specialty on the swimming team was bench warmer.
Yeah, come on, yeah.
And because of the size of my ass, nobody warmed the bench better than me, bro.
I was a chubby little kid myself, so I know what that was like. But you said that they came out looking for some male roles for a play. They came by the swimming pool, and is part of the story I read, and that's how you kind of got into acting a little bit.
Yeah, you know, they as they do in these public high schools, I guess. You know, they have a notion that culture is important. So they were doing this play.
Yeah.
And as happens, 55 girls showed up for the audition, but no boys. So they went hat in hand from department to department, just trying to recruit boys to, you know, they were shanghaiing. They weren't recruiting. They were shanghaiing boys to audition for this epic. And my swimming coach knew that I wasn't doing the swimming team that much good, so maybe I could, you know, maybe I could contribute elsewhere.
Yeah,
that's how that all started.
Did you have? I mean, I know your dad was a bit of a performer and a musician, and did you have some sort of in the back of your mind some interest in performing at that point, or was that just, you know, you're a kid and it's like, hey, something different to do, and there's girls, maybe check it out. What was? Was there anything going on?
Well, I mean, you know, because everybody in my family kind of did something. There were singers, there were violin players, there were drummers, there were pianists. Mm-hmm. Most of them were musicians, but everybody was a performer. And so, you know, it's not a big surprise that I ended up doing something performance-oriented. But there were no actors, so there was no reason to believe it would have been that particular discipline. It just so happens, and I say this with nothing but love for my fellow artisans, acting is the one performing art that requires no skill and no discipline. So I was a shoo-in.
Come on. You have to have a little bit of skill in this one. I know you've said that you think of all the art forms, especially film, storytelling through film, is one of the sort of, you think, strongest forms of storytelling compared to painting or fiction or whatever it might be. Why do you feel that way? What is it about that art form that you think sort of delivers the story maybe more effectively than others?
I'm not saying it's more effective. I'm saying it's my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
because it requires all the others.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only one that's completely multidimensional. You know, magnitude of music is utilized in film, the glory of the image as painters and photographers capture it is the benchmark of film. The discussion of behavior and the human condition as performed by what's on the page and then enacted by the actors is as philosophic a discussion as you're ever going to find. So every single one of the art forms comes together, and there's upwards of 200 to 400 people working on a film, all of which are experts in various other arts. And they come together to create this one beautiful piece of work. I mean, when it's done well and it's done beautifully, then it's just glorious. And we have, what, 100 years of amazing cinema to prove that theory.
You had said something about in writing the book that one of the motivations was, you know, maybe people can figure out what they were put here to do, which struck me because in my previous life, before being a comedian and an actor, I was an attorney and a banker on Wall Street, and I quit to pursue this. And I thought I had my life figured out, but then I didn't, and I had to find this, or it found me. And it seems like that there's been part of that sort of thread through your life of sort of figuring out what you were put here to do and getting settled with it and happy with it. And talk about that a little bit and why you think this book sort of helps sort of get that message out there to people.
I don't know. I just, I realized more. I mean, the minute I was given the assignment or given the space, it wasn't really an assignment. It was kind of self-assigned, but
yeah.
By having a publisher jump on board and say, "Yeah, we'll let you make this book," so I was given the space. It occurred to me that I'd been through a lot of shit, and some of it was really, really tough. Some of it was really glorious, and there was a lot of stuff in between. And it also occurred to me that it was not unlike anybody else's life. We all lose people. We all fail at certain things. We all have really dark periods. And we all lose friends and family, and some of us come out of it differently than others. I happen to have come out really, really strong at the best point in my life right now. Things are going, I couldn't even write. If I was to write a letter to God, I couldn't get anything better than what I have in life right now. So I felt there was a need to show my gratitude and maybe even chronicle the journey a little bit in case there was a way for it to let everybody else know what's possible, and I'm not saying there's one right or wrong way of doing it. I'm just saying this is what happened to me, and you're welcome to have a look at it and see if there's anything in here that you can glean or know that you're not the only one going through some of this shit. And if not, just on a pure entertainment basis, there's a lot of stories about Brando and Sinatra.
Yeah. Well, it really hit home with me because it actually did have that effect on me, because as a performer, the things, and I think that this applies even if you're not a performer, you talk about sort of the downtime, you're waiting for the phone to ring and it doesn't ring, especially after you do amazing work, and you win a Golden Globe and you think things are on a roll and they're not, and it's an up and down business. And I've been dealing with those struggles and continue to deal with those struggles and waiting for that break to come. And so it was really impactful to read that because, someone like yourself, from afar, it's like, man, this guy has the world by the tail and has had the world by the tail, but to see the struggle that you went through and that you came through the other side, to the point where, you got so low for you that there was an suicide attempt. And you talk about that in the book. What did you take from all of that? If you were giving me advice in terms of those dark times where you sit there and go, I got this talent, why isn't the rest of the world seeing it? I don't know if you've had that conversation in your head with yourself, Like, How do you sort of get your head around that and come out the other side?
I mean, a lot of it you have no control over. You have no control over whether the phone is ringing or not. But you do have control over how you manage your way through these slings and arrows. And for me, I was obsessed. You know, I was always really good at realizing when it was me that was fucking up, as opposed to the world. And I was also pretty good at realizing I have no control over this. This is the world fucking up, not me.
And how are you fucking up in those moments in terms of your work ethic, in terms of your focus, or
what is that? It's all whatever the remnants of low self-esteem, of I'm not worthy, of like I don't deserve to be. And so when you feel those things, you're going to actually do things in the course of your day, whether you know it or not, that are going to become self-fulfilling prophecies. So the therapy part of the book was like me, trying to just rid myself of all the distorted lenses of all the things that I was wired into as a kid for one reason or another. It wasn't fucking important to me or my therapist why that shit happened. It was just important to undo it. Mm-hmm. And so I finally got with a guy. I luckily got with a guy who, that's how he worked. He didn't work on, like, what did your mother do to you when you were eight? Or how do you feel about, they said, none of that shit matters. You don't even matter to us. These are the tools you need to turn negativity into positivity and mm-hmm. give yourself enough space to see the forest for the trees. And some of the shit you're thinking is imagined, and some of it's real. Mm-hmm. And then learning how to cope with the real shit and leave the imagined stuff behind. And once you can do that, then I think you're on your way to fighting the right fights and putting your energy into the right struggles.
But well, how do you...
Struggling on streets that you shouldn't be even walking down, you're going to fail. Nothing good is going to come of it.
And is that sort of those bad streets, the imagined part? Is that sort of the I'm not worthy, or I've never been good enough? I mean, I know you had issues with being an overweight kid, and that fed into a lot of that for you as a child, and lingered as an adult. But like what? What are those imagined areas that you have to stay away from or that generally you think people have to stay away from because you're in a business of rejection 80% of the time?
Yeah, which plays into whatever negative stuff you might have about yourself.
Right.
But when you realize, 100% of us are being rejected 98% of the time, in this particular business, it's not personal. It doesn't go back to my own, image of myself. It's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. Then you're able to say, okay, I can brush that off, pick myself up, move on to the next fight. And mm-hmm. eventually, if you're single-minded enough and healthy enough and talented enough, you're going to start succeeding. At least that's what happened to me. And I, like I said, this is not a self-help book. This is not a book like I'm telling you how to do it. I'm just showing you what happened with me. And maybe you can get something from it.
Yeah.
And said, if you can't, then just take it as a memoir of a guy who was on a couple of nice movie sets with some really cool stories.
Yeah, well, either way, it's a win-win. Once you started to kind of go down that path that sort of and be able to brush some of this stuff off, did you find your work, the quality of your work in front of the camera change at all as a result of that? Were you more relaxed as an actor as a result?
I'm still working on that. I'm still working on finding the sublimeness of the moment in the acting process. And mm-hmm. and I feel like the more comfortable I get with myself, the more frequent that's happening.
Yeah.
So I feel like, and I'm really comfortable with myself these days.
Yeah.
There's so much of this struggle gets behind. It's never going to be fully behind any of us. I mean, we're all going to be struggling all the way till they, you know, nail down the lid. But, you know, it's a question of degrees. It's a question of like, okay, tomorrow I'm going to try to go 2 degrees further than I went today. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm obsessed with acting. I'm obsessed with performing. I'm obsessed with trying to be worthy of the position I've been given, where I'm one of those lucky few actors that's getting really good work. And I'm looking at the guys on whose shoulders I'm standing who did work that blows my mind, and I'm just trying, I'm obsessed with earning, you know, that place that's been, that's been given to me.
Who are some of those?
I know when I nail it, and I know when I got a whole lot further to go. And so it's always just a process. It's never a finished result.
So maybe you've got a great idea for a business and want to start selling your products or services online. Maybe you're an established business owner looking for new customers, or maybe you're interested in starting a personal website. No matter who you are, GoDaddy wants to help you succeed online. Right now, GoDaddy is offering a .com domain for just, get this, $1.49. You know, you can't get $1.49 for $1.49. That's a bargain, people. It's go time. Start your website today. Visit GoDaddy.com and enter promo code Paul149. That's Paul149, all one word, to get your $1.49.com. Some limitations apply. See website for details.
As an actor, when you haven't gone, you just said, I know how much further I could go. Is it fear that keeps you from going there generally? Or what is the thing that doesn't let you get there sometimes?
Fear could definitely be a factor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, where's the fear coming from? Is the fear coming from there's something, I got to get to some very intimate place, very secretive, deep, private place of mine, and I have to do it in front of 150 crew guys who, and then eventually going to go on camera and the world is going to see it. You know, this is the actor's dilemma, is to break through whatever it is that's plugging up the plumbing and just let it flow. And as a human, you know, you're going to want to, the reason why it was so important for me to put all the therapy in the book is because whenever there are, you know, synapses or things that can turn into synapses between you and the flow state, which is essential for an actor, you better go work on that off on the side, because you can't use any of that shit. You have to be able to access everything right now when you're working on a movie. And there's no excuses. There's no like, sorry, man, maybe tomorrow. No, man, you know, you're a professional actor. You have to do this now. And, you know?
Are you good at compartmentalizing? Like, if there's shit going down in your life that's not cool and giving you a hard time, that you can walk on the set and sort of use the role to get you immerse yourself? I'm okay. I'm better than I used to be at compartmentalizing, but I'm still not there yet. Or have you, is that still a work in progress for you?
Yeah, I'm getting better at it. I'm getting quite good at it, actually. It wasn't always like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like I'd come in, you know, with some baggage, and that baggage would be the permeating factor all through the day. Now I say to myself, I'm going to deal with that baggage the minute I'm done doing what I'm doing here, because these guys are paying me to be here, and they expect and they deserve the best of me.
In some of the training that I've gotten as an actor, that, you know, I've been taught, you know, maybe use, if it's appropriate, to use that baggage if it fits the character and what you're doing. Do you do that, or do you not subscribe to that theory?
No, I do. I'm a firm believer in energy flow and the ability to direct it or redirect it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the word acting has at its root active. It's something that demands man's energy. And the more, even when you're having a quiet moment, there's a million things going on in your mind and behind your eyes. And that's what I mean when I say energy. It has to come over the footlights. You know, it has to be communicated to the audience.
Yeah.
You always have to be in a state where energy is flowing through you. And if you have negative energy flowing through you, you know, one of your jobs is to figure out a way to harness it and use it and use it to the character's advantage.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you talk about energy flow and also fear and, you know, in doing stand-up, like if I'm in sync with the audience, I'm completely out of my way, meaning I'm not in my head and I'm going all with my instincts and I'm vibing off the audience. And there was a time when I would give away the power, like if there was some important people in the room there, like network execs or whatever, audition, you know, looking at us, you know, checking us out. And your focus is a little bit on them. And it's all fear from my perspective. You know, it's sort of then you're operating out of fear, like, oh, I want them to like me because I want to book this job, blah, 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 blah. And you're not 100% pure in the moment, the pure artist, you know. And I think that, for me anyway, was always, and at times still is, like the challenge to sort of be stronger than all of that and just put it off to the side and completely be in the moment as the performer, the actor, the artist, you know?
Well, that's the secret of life, man. You know, the secret of life is the more you're 100% right here, right now, the better things are going to be.
Yeah.
You know, and that includes the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because, you know, when you're going through things that are bad and ugly, those things are ultimately, if you find a way to process them properly and work your way through them properly, you're going to come out the other side stronger. It's that Nietzsche quote, "What doesn't kill me makes me stronger." The reason why it's a cliche is because it's so fucking true.
Right. Yeah, I hear you. Well, you talk about the, you know, standing on the shoulders of great actors before you or contemporaries. Who were some of those people for you that either as a young actor coming up or now you look at and marvel at their work or took something from their work that you use today?
It's quite a long list. A lot of guys from a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cagney and Bogie and Errol Flynn and Spencer Tracy and Jimmy Stewart and Gary Cooper and Gable. And then a little bit after that, Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas. And then a little bit after that, Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, Redford. You know, of course, you can't leave out Brando because he kind of set the whole fucking thing on its ear and changed up. Montgomery Clift. These days, Joaquin. I think Brad Pitt's got some fucking awesome chops. I just watched, you know, Mike Nichols passing, so TCM did. Re-showed The Graduate and He's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Richard Burton was an underrated film actor.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin Hoffman, giant, little giant.
Yeah.
So there's tons of guys and, you know, there's tons of women. Jean Arthur, Barbara Stanwyck, Betty Davis was probably pound for pound as good an actor that ever came down the pike.
Mm-hmm.
Did I mention Cary Grant yet? He's my number one favorite.
No, it's funny because I just had the TV on this afternoon and they're doing, I guess, a Cary Grant day and they just two Cary Grant movies back to back. Yeah, he's I think, look, I don't know, maybe if you're, I don't know if you're penalized because if you're beautiful on camera, you don't get the credit like Brad Pitt or Cary Grant. But I agree with you. They're both really, really great actors. And Montgomery Clift was interesting because I always thought he was great, maybe a little overshadowed by James Dean and then the death of James Dean. But when you watch his work, it's really subtle and intense, almost like a young Pacino. And when he was like, you know, doing Godfather and and Serpico and that kind of thing. What was it about Cliff that drew you to him, or you took anything from him? Maybe, I don't know.
He, first of all, he's brilliant. You know, he really, really has a connection to the material on an intellectual level that is just sheerly brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a smart actor, so he immediately gets your attention. Second of all, he probably brought more subtext than any other actor prior to him.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, he was playing what he was playing, but there were three or four other layers that were always apparent in the moment, which made him so compelling that you really couldn't take your eyes off him.
Yeah.
And he did it over and over and over again. I was not a big fan of James Dean. I thought James Dean was very self-indulgent and very into showing you what a great actor he was, but he was not servicing the material. He was not playing the guy that the writer wrote, whereas Brando always was, and Montgomery Clift really always was,
mm-hmm.
playing the guy that the writer wrote. So he was servicing the material much more so than showcasing himself as like, hey, Ma, look what I can do.
Explain that for my listeners a little bit who aren't as educated in the world of acting, like how an actor might do that, where the character is being self-indulgent and sort of drawing attention to themselves by like using the set a little bit, being overly physical, using a prop of some kind on the set. Like give an example if you can. You don't have to call out Dean on it, but just in general, like how does that manifest itself?
You just you got lost in James Dean. You know, he was a virtuoso, no question about it. I mean, he probably played his instrument as good as Itzhak Perlman plays his.
Mm-hmm.
Except Itzhak Perlman is always playing Mozart or Chopin, and James Dean was playing James Dean. I don't know how to explain it any better than that.
And you've had this really interesting artistic relationship or partnership with the Guillermo del Toro, and I guess starting with Hellboy. And what was sort of a moment for you and looking back, that sort of a turning point a little bit, or opened another avenue for you? And like, why is that it seems like from afar a strong relationship, creatively, artistically. And if I'm right, like what is it about him and you that you click so well?
I mean, Guillermo, there's no need for me to chronicle his genius and his contribution to filmmaking, even in his, young kind of years. He's already become a major force in not just of his generation, but of any generation. And he's already contributed a number of things that are just going to stand the test of time. And for somebody to be identified by somebody as heavyweight as that, as this is an actor that I want to use, and not only use once, but use over and over and over again, and then continue to find these aspects of behavior in the characters he chooses for me to play that no one ever sees, me doing other than Guillermo. Like his vision of me is very singular, mm-hmm. which is why he gives me the best roles I've ever had. There's only one other guy that saw me that way, and that's Jean-Jacques Annaud. So between the two of them, I've gotten the best roles I've ever gotten because they see something in me that they want to use, and not just once, but over and over and over again.
And is that thing that they saw something that you were aware of that you were waiting for someone to pull out of you, or were you surprised that they saw that in you?
Both. I mean, I was surprised that anybody saw that in me, because my whole game was to be chameleon-like, which was some remnant of watching a combination of Charles Laughton, transform himself into the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and some of the transformative work Brando did, going from, a longshoreman to Viva Zapata to, The Godfather. I was like blown away by the chameleon-like nature of what you can do as an actor, and it became kind of a thing for me. So that was a blessing and a curse, because the blessing part of it is still waiting to be chronicled, but the curse part of it was I never gave anybody an indication of what my core was. You know, like, what do you hire this guy to do? So it became kind of like when Guillermo unearthed it, he was actually, in my mind, like solving a riddle that I was creating for myself, not knowing, not wanting to. But, you know, he found this core. He found this kind of like this thing that ran through all the work, and then harnessed it into roles that he was giving me to play that really resonated better than any other roles that had ever been given to me, because they were very much in touch with this core that I was doing everything in my power to not show anyone.
And if you could describe what that core is now, how would you describe it?
I can't. I would just say the 6 movies that I've done with Guillermo, go see them. And
yeah,
it's a variety of all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not any one thing. It's just a compendium.
Right.
Of things, but he saw it unlike anybody else, and not only did he see it once, but he continues to just hand me these little gems even to this day.
It's very relatable, because you know, in sort of writing for myself as a performer, you know, you're always questioning, okay, this is my voice, but maybe there's something more, and it's very hard to see yourself, you know, objectively, and when you can find somebody with that kind of genius who can read layers of what you have and then pull it out of you is a very special thing. And I would imagine just like must have been incredibly fulfilling for you.
Well, not only that, but it's also been game changing. I mean, you know, I think it was, you know, the opportunities that he's given me have moved me from the fringes, from the margins where most of my indie work is, into the mainstream with things like Hellboy. You know, suddenly, you know, I'm being viewed on a materialistic level completely differently than ever before, all because of Guillermo. So he's not only changed my artistic life, he's changed the whole trajectory of my life in general. And that includes spiritual, emotional, financial, and creative. Not many guys are going to come through your life or anybody's life that are going to have that kind of an impact. I can never put it even into words. I mean, even now I'm understating the impact he had on me.
That's great. Well, it sounds like you got to put him in your will. You got to leave him something.
there won't be anything left. He knows that.
You're going to blow it all, huh?
I'm blowing it, baby. I'm living large, baby.
There you go. Do you have any hobbies? Do you have any? I know you said you don't really ride motorcycles, but do you have anything like any pet things you like to do?
I play a lot of golf during my downtime.
Yeah, I play golf with my son. It's great. My son and I love to play golf. He's 14.
I got a few boys that I love being on the golf course with 5-6 hours a day.
Nice.
We turn our phones off and I play very badly, so I spend a lot of that time drinking margaritas. So I know at least part of it is going to go right.
Yeah, you go. Exactly. You got to get something.
But I also, my big thrill is working. And so my hobby is when I'm not working, I'm working at working. I'm building my own production company right now called We're Gonna Pray Pictures. Mm-hmm. So I'm in pre-production for about 4 movies right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm really, you know, this is what I love to do the most. This is where I love to spend my time. And I'm very lucky. I have a beautiful family of 4, 2 kids and a wife that I've been with for 38 years. And, when I'm not playing golf or working, it's just them.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I know about the working part. There's a coach I work with here in New York called Bob Krakauer, and you know, whenever I'm in class with him, it's like everything's right. You know, you're just working on the work, you know, and there's no bullshit, and it's not about anything else other than the work. And you come out of there energized. In doing early on, you know, some of these roles or this heavy makeup and all that, did that in some way make you be a better actor because you had to kind of really, through that makeup, convey more the what that character's going through? Do you think in some way that there was a positive benefit to being underneath all that makeup at times?
There were many positive elements of being behind all that makeup. First and foremost was how uncomfortable I was in my own skin. So the minute you put a layer of made-up skin between me and the world at large, so that I could hide behind, you freed me up to not worry about any issues I had with being self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I was basically able to immerse myself into the character.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I was in my 40s and 50s where I became comfortable enough in my own skin where I could act that freely without the makeup. So having those opportunities in my youth was very welcome and very poetically, like, wow, this is the only way I could really act this freely is if I'm transformed into something that's not me.
Yeah.
That's completely abstract and a creation outside of my own sordid, twisted, distorted vision of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thrilled that, you know, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is because looking back on the shape of my life, it really had a kind of a form to it that was that led up to why everything is so fucking cool right now.
Yeah,
and it required me making note of that so that I could basically thank God or whoever it was that was responsible for these things that happened beyond my control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense. It seems like it's all these things happened, or a lot of them, for a reason that all kind of aligned for you, and it sounds like you're in a great place. I really appreciate you coming on the show. This has been fascinating. I've been a big fan of yours. You're a great actor, and I love talking to you about acting, the craft of acting, and just your overall perspective on life and what you've been through. And a lot of people can read about it in Easy Street, The Hard Way. It's a memoir. It's out now, and it's a really great read and a really cool book. And good luck with the golf game. Have a lot of margaritas on the course. Enjoy it. And
Thank you.
Appreciate you being on, man. Really, really an honor to talk to you.
Thanks, man. My pleasure.
All right, that was Ron Perlman. How intense is that guy? Really cool. Just an actor's actor, and just a real artist, and just so cool to talk to somebody who is having such great success in a long, long story career. And he's got a great book out, Easy Street. Check it out. And check me out doing stand-up. I'm going to be back out on the road in February. All my tour dates are on my website, paulmercurio.com, or on my Facebook page, Paul Mercurio. Follow me on Twitter, and please spread the links on the podcast. Want to keep building the Paul Mercurio Nation on this. You guys are awesome. Thanks for listening, and hope you have a great holiday. Take care.
You take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf.
Because it's all our turf. Yeah!